production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. From WFIU, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats.
A charity is not justice. Charity is what a society does when there is no justice.
We'll be spending most of the show today on my conversation with Andy Fisher. He's the author of Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. We've had Amanda Nicky and Stephanie Solomon on Earth Eats talking about food pantries addressing root causes of hunger. And Angela Babb has helped us look at some of the interesting configurations around government food aid, SNAP, and Big Ag. Andy Fisher takes us further, asking tough questions about charity and how we can do the most good. It's a thought-provoking discussion, so stay with us. Coming up right after a report from Harvest Public Media on the newly passed Farm Bill. Congress controls the budget for most agriculture-related programs, and it has now passed the massive Farm Bill along to President Trump. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach, Amy Mayer, and Esther Honig break down the key parts of the bill.
Well, one of the newest things in the Farm Bill this year is legalization of hemp, which is going to be a new cash crop that a lot of farmers are going to be trying out. Esther, can you tell us about how this works in the Farm Bill?
So hemp is going to be removed as a Schedule I drug, and it's going to be just like any other crop now in the U.S. And each state is actually going to be in charge of regulating that crop. They're going to track how much of it is grown. They're going to test to make sure that these hemp plants don't have more than 0.3% THC, because if it gets too much higher, it starts to look more and more like its cousin plant, marijuana.
So it makes it legal. States have a lot of authority over how to actually make that work. But not just anybody can grow hemp. There are some limits, aren't there?
Right. There are some exceptions. And that really singles out felons, specifically folks who have a crime that's related to a controlled substance. So according to the bill, you'll have to wait a 10-year period from the date of your conviction. However, there's an exception. If you've already been growing hemp as a part of maybe your state-run pilot program, then you're sort of grandfathered in.
And if a farmer grows hemp, are they treated just like other farmers in the Farm Bill? Do they have some of the same benefits?
So that is a huge boon for this industry, because there will be access to all of these federal programs, which includes everything from, you know, low interest USDA loans to a bank account. A lot of these hemp farmers had a hard time finding access to just, you know, everyday financial tools like a credit card. But now those things will be available. And one of the most important things I've heard from farmers is that crop insurance will now be available to hemp farmers.
Crop insurance for hemp farmers. So they need a safety net just like other farmers. Amy, you've been looking at the crop insurance part of this.
That's right. And ever since the 2014 bill, crop insurance has really been identified as the primary safety net for most commodity farmers. Hemp will become one of those commodities. Crop insurance has another bill that officially governs it in many ways, but it is subsidized by the federal government. There are subsidies for the farmers when they're purchasing their premiums and for the crop insurance companies. And that's actually one of the places where there could have been some changes, those subsidies and benefits that the farmers get that didn't make it into the bill.
Right. So Senator Grassley from Iowa wanted to put some limits on who can receive crop insurance. Did he get what he wanted?
No, he didn't. He was really hoping to put some limitations on who'd be eligible for all these different farm program payments and make it a little more restrictive. But instead, they've actually expanded to a certain degree who's eligible.
What about the programs that pay farmers for conservation projects on their land? Are there many changes there?
There aren't too many changes. There will be a few more acres available for the major program, which is the Conservation Reserve Program. Several groups have looked at the text and say they think the principles and the goals of the programs will remain intact. And you know, Grant, we really need to talk about the biggest part of the Farm Bill, which is, of course, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP.
Right, the food stamp program. And for months, that was the biggest hang-up to actually coming to an agreement on how to get the bill passed. House Republicans were trying to put stricter work rules in place so more people had to work or be in job training in order to qualify for SNAP. And basically, after the midterms, they had to give up on that. It was pretty clear they weren't going to get what they wanted. And now it's basically some different programs and funding for encouraging work in the SNAP program. So a lot of those big obstacles that came up toward the end of the process ended up just falling away. And we have this bill that has more incremental changes than big reforms.
And remarkably enough, if they're actually able to get this bill through by the end of the year, it will exceed many people's expectations. When we started reporting on the Farm Bill at the beginning of 2018, I asked people when they thought it would get finished, and people were saying 2019 or even 2020. So this is something that this Republican-controlled Congress and Republican presidency can really take home as an accomplishment.
That was Harvest Public Media reporters Grant Gerlach, Amy Mayer, and Esther Honig discussing the Farm Bill, which the House and the Senate have now passed. We have Harvest Public Media's complete coverage of the Farm Bill on the Earth Eats website, or visit harvestpublicmedia.org. My guest today is Andy Fisher. He's author of the book Big Hunger and co-founder and longtime executive director of the Community Food Security Coalition. The CFSC was a national alliance of groups working on access to healthy food. The organization disbanded in 2012. I've invited Andy Fisher to Earth Eats to talk about the critiques and challenges he puts forward in his book to the food banking and food charity models that many of us are familiar with across the country. In some cases, the very organizations that some of us may be donating to and volunteering with during the holiday season. Thank you very much for being here, Andy Fisher. Yes. If you could just tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to write the book, Big Hunger.
For 17 years, I ran the Maine National Alliance of groups working on access to food and local food. So I was at the kind of at a front row seat with major national anti-hunger groups and did a lot of work trying to educate and pull the anti-hunger community more towards a focus on sustainability and prevention and public health, and saw a lot of success and saw a lot of struggles. And during that time period, what became evident was that we weren't solving the problem of hunger and that food insecurity was stagnating or getting worse in many occasions, while income inequality was getting worse as well. But the anti-hunger community was building relationships with corporate America, Walmart, and I'll get into that a little bit later. And, you know, Walmart, for example, just has the obvious implications of it, of its low wages. And those partnerships became evident that they were holding the anti-hunger community back from fully addressing the problem. So after I left my job in 2011, I was privy to a lot of information, a lot of knowledge that I hadn't been able to really make public while I was employed. So once I became unemployed, it was easier for me to bring to light those conversations that were happening around me.
Your book is called Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. And I just think that is a great place to start. If you could just tell us, what is this unholy alliance you just started to talk
sure.
about?
Sure. Anti-hunger groups over the years have developed very tight relationships with industry. And in many ways, those relationships have a positive impact, and that's why they do them. For example, in the advocacy end of things, anti-hunger groups lobby closely with industry. And industry spent, for example, in 2013, they spent $60 million lobbying for the Farm Bill on SNAP. And they lobby together, in many cases, to protect the program because it's a huge source of revenue for the food industry, $60 billion a year just for SNAP. For example, anti-hunger groups and the beverage industry lobby together to protect the continued ability of SNAP recipients to purchase soda in the SNAP program, so to the tune of about $6 billion a year. Again, there's about $80 billion in federal food programs if you count SNAP, WIC, school lunches, et cetera. So that money is going largely into the pockets of industry. So in doing my research, I found that there's a number of studies that find that if you're going to try to reduce poverty, if you want to create jobs, if you want to put money into tax coffers, if you want to keep money in local communities, you don't invest those resources into big corporations. You invest them into locally owned businesses, small businesses, medium-sized businesses that are more responsive to their communities. So I ask, you know, couldn't we be spending that $85 billion better? Couldn't we be spending that money in a way that supports locally communities' economies, that invests in poverty reduction, that invests in job creation better than putting the money into the pockets of Walmart or Tyson, many of whom have exploitative practices? So that's part of the Unholy Alliance. The other part of the Unholy Alliance is that you see food banks partnering very closely with industry. About 22% of food bank board members come from Fortune 1000 companies. And that's, you know, that is what it is. That's fine on some level. But those relationships are holding food banks back from advocating on things like minimum wage and affordable housing, on tax policy, on immigration, because those policies are not in the interests of their business partners. The relationships being very strong with food banks and corporations around food donations, around cash donations, around technical expertise, that are all integrating them in a very tightly knit web, of which interests industry as much as it interests the food banks, because it enables them to whitewash their reputations, enables them to appear to be hunger fighters, and to continue their core business practices in many cases, which are exploitative and actually causing food insecurity rather than solving it. The anti-hunger lobbyists in Washington, you know, feel that they need to build as broad a tent as possible to support the SNAP program, to make sure that it, you know, continues through Congress and to fight off Republican cutbacks.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So they feel like they are not powerful enough to do it themselves. So they have allied themselves with industry. And SNAP is a $60-ish billion program, of which the vast majority of that money is going into the pockets of big food and big ag. For example, Kraft says 1/6 of its sales come from SNAP. Walmart redeems $13 billion worth of SNAP in 2014. So those are huge amounts of revenue for these companies. And when there are cutbacks to SNAP, when there's threats of cutbacks to SNAP, their stocks fall. So it's a very clear benefit. It's a very important revenue source for them. If you look at the SNAP program, there's a front end and a back end. The front end is the individuals who receive the EBT cards that they can use at the supermarket. It's absolutely vital for them, mm-hmm. and is absolutely vital program to protect their ability to feed themselves. And on some level, the industry support keeps that going. Mm-hmm. But it's not altruism. It's not philanthropy. They're doing it because they're also protecting their interest. I come from a food system perspective. I come from a kind of looking at the impacts of the food industry on the environment, on workers, on people's health. And you see time and time again with many of the major food producers that their practices are not in the public interest. Tyson, for example, exploits its workers, exploits its farmers directly. You know, Walmart pays subliving wages. You know, Smithfield is producing massive amounts of hog waste that are affecting communities very negatively. And, I mean, so there's story after story after story of that exploitation. So we're subsidizing that behavior. We're subsidizing those types of practices with our public money. Is that in our values? Is that a good thing? What's the collateral damage we're causing by doing that? I ask, is there not a better way to invest that money? To use, as Kevin Morgan, who's a professor in Wales, says, to use the power of the public plate. How can we use public procurement dollars through SNAP, through school lunch, through WIC, to foster a food system whose values we support and which supports social and public goods?
I know that you've done some work with the Farm to School program. And so that feels like one of those places where you could start to see a shift. Could you explain that and talk a little
sure.
bit about that?
So the National School Lunch Program operates in almost every school around the country. There has been an effort over the past 20 years or so to improve the quality of school lunches, improving nutrition standards as the last administration did. But some of the efforts have also been around making direct connections between local farmers and school districts. So school districts are spending an increasing amount of money purchasing food from local farmers. And in Portland, Oregon, the Portland Public School buys about 40% of its food from Oregon growers. It's a win-win-win. I mean, mm-hmm. it's providing better food, fresher food into the cafeterias. The kids are eating it are accepting it and liking it better because it's better quality, and it's providing some income into the pockets of local farmers. So it's improving the local economy.
It just seems like a really good example of exactly what you were talking about, and what kind of drove you into this was seeing that couldn't this money be serving the local community a little bit better?
Absolutely. Thank you.
I'm speaking with Andy Fisher, author of the book Big Hunger. We'll return to our conversation in a moment. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
The anti-hunger work, which centers around feeding people in through food pantries, through food banking, it's not getting at the root causes of hunger. Could you talk a little bit about some of those root causes? And
sure. Can I tell a quick story?
Yes,
okay.
Please.
So, story I'd like to tell is of my son. His name is Orion, like the constellation. And Orion was in third grade a few years ago, and he came home really excited because there was going to be a food drive in his class, and it was a competition between his class and all the other classes in the school, and whichever class raised the most food and the most money would get a pizza party. Perfect thing to motivate a third grader, right? So he comes in stripping the cupboard bare, looking for the heaviest food he can find. Takes it, goes back to school, all's good. Week passes, the deadline for the food drive is coming near. I'm out on my way out to the grocery store. Ryan tells me, Dad, you got to get me some heavy food. So I'm at the grocery store thinking about, you know, the cost per pound ratio of food and, you know, what's heavy and what's cheap. And I go, oh, my God, I could get him a 2-liter bottle of, like, Pepsi or something like that. And I couldn't do it. But that's the type of thing that fits that food drive, right? But as I was shopping, I realized that there was just something here that was bugging me about this food drive, and that it's a microcosm of the emergency food system of food banking. And that is that they measure their success in terms of the pounds that they distribute and the people that they serve. The more pounds that they put out, the more people they serve, the more they appear to be successful, the happier they are. And they keep doing that in their strategic plans of you know, trying to grow. And it's this kind of corporate growth model of the more we do, the better we are. But when you really take a step back and look at it, yeah, you're successful in averting hunger for a family for a day or for a week or however long their food box lasts. But they're coming back next month, or they're coming back in 3 months or 6 months. We see this kind of entrenched food insecurity more and more within food banking, where it's not just a one-off, where it's not just getting people over that hump, but it's people are relying on that food. It's maintenance food. It's not emergency food. So what does that food really do? It helps people on a temporary basis, which is great, important, essential. But is it getting at the underlying causes, which is poverty? It's not getting at that. What is really behind hunger is a lack of resources with which to purchase food, which is derived from not a poor wages. We don't have high unemployment currently, but we have unstable unemployment. It's hard for people to get full-time work. We have a poor educational system, which it makes it difficult to get a job. We have a lot of racism and sexism, misogyny in our society that underlie a lot of the hunger and the poverty in our country, especially when you look at, you know, who's hungry. It's people of color and it's women. So we need to be addressing those more structural issues.
What about the fact that people are hungry right now?
Absolutely. I mean, hunger is something that, you know, is not going to wait. People can't wait. Hunger doesn't wait for the revolution for tomorrow. So that's the success and that's the reason behind emergency food system is helping those people out who need that help on a today basis.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the ways you feel like these kinds of organizations, food banks and food pantries, could begin to not – I don't think you're advocating that people should just shut down their food pantries and
Absolutely.
Stop feeding people.
Absolutely
but,
not.
But what's a way? What are ways that they could continue that work and also begin to address some of those root causes?
Sure. I do think that, you know, we've seen a growth curve of food banking since it originated in the early 1980s to the point where we are now. We're to serving 46 million people, about $5 billion worth of food. So the question I ask is that a good thing, or are we kind of digging ourselves deeper into a rut every year with that growth? You know, how can we bend that curve down? Mm-hmm. To we 10, 20 years, we have a much more sustainable amount of food being distributed. So, you know, what we've seen is there's a lot of change in the anti-hunger community. There's a lot of change in the food banking community, especially these days. A lot more food banks are starting to implement community development projects. They're working in community gardens. They're buying from local farmers. They're organizing rural communities around self-reliance. They're doing job training. They're doing, you know, a whole variety of things that are helping people get out of poverty and helping communities be more sustainable. And they're also doing a much better job of providing healthier food. So that work has been, you know, widely accepted and is moving forward quickly. Where I see the hardest problems is around economic justice. I see it very hard for food banks to engage on public policy advocacy around the minimum wage, around affordable housing, and fighting for DACA, fighting for immigration reform, or fighting for universal health care. They've stayed away from those controversial issues because they're afraid of alienating their bipartisan across the political spectrum set of donors. It's much more challenging for them to kind of engage on the left, if you will, than to maintain kind of status quo on the right. Part of what I'm talking about as well is that the leadership of anti-hunger groups are people that look like me. They're white, they're male, they're middle class. They're not coming from the ranks of folks who are poor. And if you look at the board of directors of many food banks, you know, they're white and male, or maybe white and female. But they're not, you know, they're not people of color. They're not clients. We could do a lot better job of organizing the 46 million people who receive food, who receive charity, the 40 million people who are on SNAP, the 80 to 100 million people who are donors to food banks across the country at any time during the year. I mean, that's a huge slice of the American population. If we can mobilize those people, even a small section of those people, towards action, we'd have a much different society, much different response to hunger.
I mean, I feel like a big part of what you're talking about is income inequality, which I think we know is growing. That is a big problem to address. It's a big problem for food banks and food pantries to take on.
Yeah, it is a big problem. I mean, I think it's one of the defining issues of our generation. The question is, what do we do about it? And where do we go with it? And I think if we don't, we see some really clear political implications. I grew up in Youngstown, Ohio, which, as you probably all know, was a very thriving steel town until about early 1980s. The bottom fell out when the steel industry left. I grew up with, you know, the kids of the steel workers. The parents, you know, worked in steel mills, made a decent middle class living, had a boat, went on vacation. You know, they had a decent life. The bottom fell out in the early 80s. And since then, the economy has never really recovered in Youngstown. It's, you know, lost. It's a shell of what it once was. The people who have stayed, most of them have left, but the people who have stayed are perhaps working at Walmart, or they're perhaps working at the private prison, or, you know, if they've lucky, they found a job at the Chevy assembly plant. So Trumbull County has always voted Democratic. I mean, back to 1972, but it's been a solidly blue county for the past 50 years. For the first time, they voted Republican. They voted for Trump in 2016. Why? You know, everybody there is asking why. What happened? And, you know, I think the conventional wisdom is that we didn't provide, as a society, we didn't provide them with good options. We never focused on bringing back the manufacturing jobs. We never focused on wages. We never focused on those self-reliance strategies that people care about. And I think we have to look at, you know, the emergency food system as part of that, the anti-hunger community as part of that. You know, the solutions that we've offered them as an anti-hunger community have been ones that they don't want. They've been SNAP. Right? Nobody wants to be reliant on government benefits and charity, which is even worse in many ways. The anti-hunger community has not invested enough attention and effort into those broader anti-poverty strategies. They've not built those alliances with labor, for example, to help bring those jobs back. Instead, they built their alliances with Walmart. And the political implications are really clear. We've seen it in the 2016 election.
You know, I know in the work that Mother Hubbard's Cupboard has been doing, and I've worked with them before, and I've had them here on the program and spoken about changing this narrative of hunger and looking at the charity model and starting to look at things from a social justice perspective instead. And I think people's first reaction to that is, what's wrong with charity? Isn't charity a good thing? Shouldn't we all be more charitable? So could you talk a little bit about the critique of the concept of charity?
Sure. Charity is wonderful, right? I'm not going to tell people not to be charitable. I'm not arguing that people should be mean-spirited or not give anything to somebody in need. But charity shouldn't be the primary way we address hunger in our society. Charity is not justice. Charity is what a society does when there is no justice. It is fundamentally at odds with the concept of the right to food. The idea behind it is that people have a right to food, not that's provided by the government, not that the government's going to, you know, give everybody their groceries, but that the government has the responsibility to ensure that everybody has the ability to acquire food in a dignified manner. And I think there's some inherent barriers and inherent downsides to charity insofar as that they are not dignified. There's a price to pay in our dignity when we have to rely on charity every day. Nick Saul, who wrote a great book called The Stop, talks about charity and food banking as a death by a thousand cuts to the soul. If you talk to a lot of clients of food banks, food pantries, they will tell you the same thing, that it's not a dignified way of having to feed yourself. So by yes, on one level, charity is wonderful, but we need to be preventing poverty in the first place. We need to be moving towards a society that creates structures in which people aren't hungry, in which people don't need charity. We need to make charity obsolete by and large. It is not a sustainable nor healthy nor a positive way for a society to operate when we have to rely on charity to the extent that we have.
I was thinking about your child's food drive.
Sure. That food drive is teaching families across the country that the solution to hunger is to throw a few cans into a barrel. Or you write that $50 check at Christmas and, you know, you feel good about yourself because you did the right thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you did the right thing on some level, but it's the easy thing. So we need to get beyond the easy thing and start doing the hard thing.
I've been speaking with anti-hunger activist and author Andy Fisher. Find out more about his book, Big Hunger, on our website, eartheats.org. Production support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world, offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats, located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic, clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Thanks to everyone who helps out with the show, including Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, everyone at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Andy Fisher and everyone at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young. I produce the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.